This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ray Allen was very good at playing pro basketball. Everybody knows that. During his 18 seasons in the NBA, Allen established himself as one of the best shooters in league history.
Ray Allen first learned about the Holocaust when he was in middle school.
We read Anne Frank's diary. I didn't know if it was just a story that people told. I didn't realize it was an actual event until I watched Schindler's List in 1993.
Was ist das? Ist das Bach? Ist das Bach?
Nein, Mozart.
Mozart? Ja.
When Schindler's List opened in movie theaters, Ray Allen was a rising star at the University of Connecticut. The Milwaukee Bucks chose him with a fifth pick in the 1996 NBA draft. While the Bucks were on an East Coast road trip in 1998, team owner Herb Cole invited Allen to join him on a tour of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C.
And it was scary. The room with the hair, the room with the shoes, it was human. You've seen the real human side of it. This wasn't just a museum of wax figures or ideas. It was something that belonged to real people. They were annihilated.
Soon, Ray Allen would encourage his teammates to join him on tours of the Holocaust Museum whenever the Bucks were in Washington to play the Wizards. When he was traded to the Seattle Supersonics and later to the Boston Celtics, he did the same.
I met him almost 10 years ago when he brought the Boston Celtics to the museum.
Andres Abril is with the U.S. Holocaust Museum.
I recall Rondo, I recall Big Baby, I recall Scalabrine.
But what he remembers most is Ray Allen's quiet intensity.
He doesn't say a lot. He wanted his teammates to have an experience that was meaningful for them, and so I think he knew that letting it happen was the way to do it.
The Celtics would go on to win the 2008 NBA title. By this time, Allen had established himself as one of the greatest shooters of all time. He picked up another title with the Miami Heat and retired from basketball in 2014. That meant more time for family and for charity work, and for playing an occasional round of golf with President Obama, who appointed Allen to the United States Holocaust Memorial Council in 2016. Allen wanted to learn about the Holocaust in depth and up close.
To see and to feel what these people went through, to put my feet on those grounds.
It was time for a trip to Poland.
The idea was my idea.
That's Rabbi Simon Taylor. He hadn't even known who Ray Allen was until they met at a fundraiser. But after he heard Allen speak about the Holocaust, Taylor told him,
"You have to go to Poland and learn more and see for yourself."
Taylor had been to Poland several times. His family on his paternal grandfather's side had lived there before the war. Most of them were murdered in the Holocaust. On April 30th, 2017, Taylor and Allen bumped into a large group of school kids who were also traveling to Poland to learn about the Holocaust.
We got all the kids together in the airport terminal, and Ray spoke to them about how important it is to go to Poland, and he hadn't even been himself yet. And then, of course, you know, he fielded a bunch of other questions about basketball as well.
The small delegation consisted of Taylor, Ray Allen, and two of his friends. They landed in Poland on May 1st. They had planned a three-day trip, and Allen wanted to see all he could. They began at Warsaw ghetto sites. They met nuns at a nearby monastery where hundreds of Jews had been saved from the Nazis. And then
Ray got to meet an actual Holocaust survivor.
Moshe Tirosh is the last survivor of the Warsaw Zoo. As a six-year-old boy, Tirosh and his sister were hidden for weeks in the basement of zookeepers Jan and Antonina Zabinski, who saved hundreds of Jews during the Nazi occupation.
And Moshe got to show Ray all around the zoo, the house, exactly where he hid, the crazy conditions, and explained to him the really gruesome stories of things that he saw and what he went through to survive. To watch Ray revere this Holocaust survivor as him being the hero and to eat up every word that he had to say, reliving his memories from hiding in the zoo, it was very special.
The next day, the group headed to Auschwitz, where over a million Jews were murdered.
And it was freezing. I was dressed from top to bottom, warm, and I could only imagine what the people in the camps felt like, wearing only pajamas and some of them with no shoes and no socks. and people slept on straw. And if you slept on the bottom bunk, you were sleeping on the ground. There's nowhere that you can hide. You stripped of any humanity, you could tell how it just would break everybody down.
Ray came out of Auschwitz very moved and felt a connection to Auschwitz and the Holocaust that he never had before, however much he had read and however many museums he'd been to. Standing in those places and seeing with your own eyes and hearing the stories and the places where they actually happened is a completely different experience.
I think it's a trip that every person should make.
But the trip wasn't over yet. Rabbi Simon Taylor.
There was a family from this small town that were excavating to extend their house. And it turned out that part of the foundation of their house was built using Jewish tombstones.
During World War II, Jewish headstones were stolen and used as construction materials. Allen and Taylor met up with a group of descendants of Holocaust survivors who rescue the desecrated stones.
We went and studied the tombstones to see who did these tombstones belong to, what type of people, what age, where do they come from. Ray, being a 6'6" athlete, was far more useful at schlepping these stones than me. And we went straight to the Jewish cemetery, where I actually had the privilege to lead the ceremony, where we returned the Jewish tombstones to a Jewish cemetery where they belong. And the family that returned them felt like they had done the right thing. Ray felt like he'd done a great thing. And of course, me being the rabbi, was delighted to have these tombstones where they belong in the Jewish cemetery.
So we did that, and then we went to another home where a family actually hid 6 Jews in their kitchen floor.
That was in the small Polish town of Czepelow. At the beginning of the Nazi occupation, a Polish family of 10 lived in that house.
A very, very modest, small cottage that still stands. It has a floorboard in the kitchen that you can remove and see a very dark, cramped basement.
And we actually went down into the hole, and the walls were wet. They were sweating down there. It was cold down there. Somebody in the town told the Nazis that they were hiding a Jewish family down there, and the Nazis came over there.
The Nazis didn't find any Jews hiding in the house, but they decided to punish the family anyway, with a death sentence for the entire family. 10 family members lived in the house, but one of their little boys wasn't home. The Nazis had to make their quota of 10, so they took another little boy from the house next door.
They killed everybody in the house. And the little boy who wasn't present, he came home to learn that everybody was executed in his barn.
That little boy grew up and raised a family of his own. Ray Allen and the delegation met his grandson, who now lives in the house. Ray wanted to share that experience in Poland with his friends and family. He Snapchatted at each stop during his 3 days there. That opened him up to some criticism.
Ray was getting a lot of pushback from friends and a lot of people on social media saying, Ray, why is this such a big priority for you? You're a black man who's not Jewish. Why are you focusing so much on this and doing a whole trip to Poland? Each person that he received a message from on social media and each person he got a call from, he took on that battle to tell them why they were wrong and why this is absolutely what he should be doing and why everybody needs to be learning about the Holocaust.
After returning home, Allen wrote an essay for the Players Tribune. In it, he said, I didn't go to Poland as a black person, a white person, a Christian person, or a Jewish person. I went as a human being. But as a black man, he sees a connection to the Holocaust.
Looking at this country and look at the tragedies that have taken place in this country, in the history of this country, for black people, we're still fighting for acceptance, still fighting for equality. And I just ask that people have empathy. Even a successful black man in this country, I still get treated unfairly. There's racism towards me every single day.
Ray Allen says he'll continue to refute those who deny and distort the Holocaust, and he wants to educate more children about it. Andres Abril says Allen is the right man for the job.
He's a different kind of personality than most of the other people who are appointed to the council. He's not the first non-Jew by any stretch. He most decidedly is the very first NBA player to be appointed. I think he brings a power of a different voice. He brings a legitimizing perspective.
He is an amazing guy, a well-known, famous athlete who is using his time to educate others and promote such important causes to change the world and make a difference. And he's so committed to it.
Alan also wants to go to Israel and back to Poland to learn even more about the Holocaust. And he wants to visit Robben Island in South Africa, where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned for 18 years.
You know, we learn what we need to do to move forward so we can make sure that certain things don't happen in this world ever again.
That story was reported and produced by Only a Game's Gary Wallach. You can learn more about Ray Allen's basketball career in his recent book, From the Outside. It's World Cup time, and never mind that the U.S. men aren't in it. The world is watching, and so am I. It has not always been so. 'Twas a time when I laughed along with graybeard U.S. sports writers who dismissed soccer as dumb because the players couldn't use their hands. Right, I thought. Wrong, I now know. How'd that happen? On cold mornings, I watched my daughters in bright shirts, learning gradually that chasing the ball in a swarm was no way for a team to play. In the company of those daughters, I watched the U.S. women's team play Norway, and we learned a lot together. Several years later, while interviewing Julie Foudy in a conference room in a Connecticut hotel, I mentioned those daughters. Julie excused herself, went to her room, and came back with two photographs that she autographed for my kids. When the New England Revolution arrived, I sat in the press box between two loquacious writers, both superb teachers of the intricacies of the game, patient, tolerant, and gentle with their corrections. On a trip to Spain, jet-lagged nearly to the point of hallucination, I saw FC Barcelona play at home in the company of 100,000 other people. They waved banners and sang, and I embraced their team. When the Boston Breakers began playing at Nickerson Field, just across the street from work, I split a season ticket package with a neighbor and his family. My wife, my daughters, and I saw half the Breakers' home games, which featured, among others, this country's most durable and accomplished player, Christine Lilly. And then there's the World Cup. One image will suffice. In 2010, in a restaurant full of Spanish speakers, I watched Spain, a team committed to playing with finesse and joy, hold off a team from the Netherlands, the coach of which had apparently decided before the game that his only hope lay in mugging the opposition. Spain prevailed. Soccer prevailed. I left that restaurant as happy as any team from the U.S. could have made me. It's too bad the U.S. didn't make the cut this time around, but if you've decided not to watch the tournament for that reason, reconsider. No game can do more than temporarily distract us from the real and stubborn tensions between regions, religions, and races. But for the duration of the World Cup, we're invited to join billions of fans from all over the world in the celebration of the most popular game the residents of the planet have devised. It is not an insignificant invitation. How serious was baseball for comic George Carlin? As serious as a heart attack?
Somewhere in the fourth or fifth inning, I think it was, he started having some chest symptoms, and he said, "I think I'm having a heart attack."
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know.
Okay, quickly, anything you want to say to any of your fans?
Fans, we did it. Get some beers, get some whatever, and start celebrating. We're the Stanley Cup champions.
That is the very happy Washington Capitals captain, Alexander Ovechkin, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by NHL.com's Amelie Benjamin and NBC Sports Boston's Michael Holly. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Bill, good to see you. Amelie, good to see you as well.
Amelie, please begin for us.
Now, unfortunately for the citizens of Washington, D.C., I'm not sure there is any beer left in the city after Alex Ovechkin and the rest of the Capitals have celebrated and celebrated and celebrated the Stanley Cup final. Now, it's always fun to see a team win a championship, especially a team winning for the first time in their 43-year history. But what has made this week even more fun has been the way that Alex Ovechkin has not only cemented his legacy as one of the all-time Stanley Cup greats, one of the all-time NHL greats, but the way he has cemented his legacy as one of the all-time great celebrators. We have seen him celebrating in fountains, dancing shirtless, doing push-ups, because definitely need to show off your physique at this time. We have seen him singing We Are the Champions, doing everything from at a Nationals game to grilling on his lawn. We have seen him probably not let go of the Stanley Cup for, I think, a week. So that has been the most fun thing to watch him, perhaps having imbibed a little bit and just celebrating with his whole heart, his whole being, as he has had this great weight lifted off his chest, becoming finally a Stanley Cup champion.
Michael, I assume you'll agree he is a world-class partier.
He's a world-class partier, and he deserves the chance to party. I've never seen a 50-goal scorer, which he's done in his career. I've never seen a 50-goal scorer more maligned than Alexander Ovechkin. And he has been, like a lot of superstars are, he has been blamed for things that have nothing to do with him. So when the Capitals have flamed out in the playoffs or not lived up to expectations, people haven't always looked at the complete story. It's always, well, Ovechkin's got to do more. So I'm happy to see him get his due and get some beers.
I guess the new wrinkle on a story like this would be if one of the new champions were to say, you know, turning over police cars is no way to celebrate, folks. Or maybe don't forget to have a designated driver. But that may be too much to expect in a context like this, Emily.
You know, I think they get a little bit of time to just do as they will. I mean, we've seen things like TJ Oshie drinking a beer through his Capitals jersey. So, you know, we'll see what happens as the summer goes on and we get into those Stanley Cup days in Moscow, say.
I had to replay that a few times. TJ Oshie, you know, through the shirt. I've seen it. Well, how much spillage will there be? He's done that before. That's what I've come to that conclusion, that this is not a first-time thing for him.
That's sort of his signature move now.
Too good. He was just too good at it.
Moving on to some World Cup news, FIFA has awarded the 2026 World Cup to the U.S., Canada, and Mexico joint bid, and it wasn't competitive. The U.S., Canada, and Mexico ganged up on little Morocco. Merit has something to do with FIFA's choice, I'm sure, but the suggestion that putting the tournament in North America is going to generate $11 billion no doubt got the delegates' attention. This is, after all, FIFA. Anyway, it's a good thing. Three countries cooperating to stage a big party. What could be better? Also, all three countries have excellent soccer facilities, so there should be minimal waste and graft and bribery in terms of construction, or at least theoretically. And I presume Canada will provide real grass for the men, though they failed to do that for the most recent Women's World Cup. Does anybody have anything negative to say about the location of the 2026 World Cup?
I don't have anything negative to say about it, and I would say the number one thing that stands out to me is that this was transparent, because when we saw with the previous World Cup locations, people wound up saying after they were announced, Russia this year, Qatar, like, how did that happen? And then we found out that there was corruption. So now...
And we were shocked.
Yeah. Oh, hey, wait a minute. This time, they did it the right way. People knew that their votes were going to be public. So now you have to be accountable for what you vote for. And once that was the case, it was a pretty lopsided vote in favor of North America. I think it's a good thing.
Emily, you started making plans for 2026?
I actually have. I mean, we are a soccer family. My one-year-old son has a full Tottenham Spurs kit. So we are ready. He'll be 9 years old in 2026, and we are more than ready, hoping maybe one of those games or two will be in Boston. So fingers crossed for that.
As someone told me the other day, I can almost assure you that a game will be at Gillette Stadium in Boston.
Well, maybe by 2026, Mr. Kraft will have built an actual soccer stadium, and it won't have to be in a football stadium.
That's right. You say it. You can keep saying that. I'm with you. I'll endorse that 2-3 times over.
I'm in.
All right. So much for the 2026 World Cup. Now, let's wrap up this as quickly as we can so I can get back to the 2018 World Cup, please, Michael.
Well, I want to tell you that it's not often that something positive can come from an injury, but that's what happened in 2000. Well, it started in 2015 in St. Louis. Reggie Bush was playing for the San Francisco 49ers at the time. He had a punt return. The momentum and the coverage took him out of bounds. Now, at the time in St. Louis, the Edward Jones Dome, they had a cement ring around the field. It was called the Ring of Death, very unsafe conditions. So that was in November of 2015. In January of 2016, the owner of the then St. Louis Rams had a proposal that he wanted to move from St. Louis to Los Angeles. It was a 29-page proposal, and most of it was spent bashing the city of St. Louis and the facility. He called it one of the worst stadiums in sports. He said it didn't have great amenities, on and on. So Reggie Bush decides, wait a minute, I agree with you, Mr. Stan Kroenke. I think I will sue the city of St. Louis and the St. Louis Rams. Well, fast forward to 2018, St. Louis was dropped as a defendant in the case. And so now it was Reggie Bush versus the now Los Angeles Rams. A jury in St. Louis awarded Reggie Bush $12.5 million for injuries that he suffered, effectively ending his career, ending his productive career. He played one more season, and he didn't do much. Unfortunately, lawyers sometimes say things that are beyond reason, incomprehensible. One of the lawyers said, well, maybe his knee had problems before he slipped out of bounds. Or, and this is the worst one, 20 years, we've been here 20 years and nobody else has been injured on this concrete surface. Why did he have to be the one? Couldn't he have done something different?
Emily, did the judicial system get this one right?
I think it is a little bit of a, not to use this as a pun here, but a little bit of a slippery slope. But I do think that there is some revenge factor for those St. Louis jurors saying, oh, really? You're going to go to Los Angeles? Well, here's an extra line item on the bill in your move.
My only hesitation in agreeing with you 100% on this, Michael, is that my understanding is that Mr. Bush got the money because he made a convincing case that his workplace was unsafe. Couldn't any player in the National Football League make that case about any facility in the National Football League?
Bill, how long before
a lawsuit breaks out every time somebody hits his head?
I think you're right. I'm not sure that's a totally negative thing because it puts the onus on the franchise to make sure these conditions are safe. Now, I thought you were going to go another level and say, well, they are playing a sport and concussions.
That's the level I was seeking to reach, and you got there for me.
And so I guess that's the irony of it. Every time you go out there, every time you put on a uniform, you can make the case that it's an unsafe condition. But you can't obviously do things like that. And there's some franchises that need to replace their field turf, franchises that have structures too close to the field. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that this sets a good precedent in my mind. I do reserve the right to change my mind if this goes out of control in the next 2 to 3 years and guys are saying, hey, wait a minute, I slipped unencumbered to the end zone. Your stadium had something to do with it.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been NHL.com's Emily Benjamin and NBC Sports Boston's Michael Holley. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Bill.
Baseball begins in the spring, the season of new life.
Football begins in the fall when everything is dying.
That's George Carlin. His often controversial career as a comic, social critic, and actor spanned half a century. The comedy routine in which he drew various distinctions between baseball and football, some of them silly, some profound, outlived its creator. He died 10 years ago.
Baseball has a seventh-inning stretch.
Football has the two-minute warning.
My dad really, he was fascinated by language. That was the biggest pull for him.
Kelly Carlin is George's only child. Like many kids without siblings, she spent a lot of time entertaining herself. She remembers the day it must have occurred to her father, who was performing all over the country, that perhaps it would be a good idea to add to his repertoire the role of available dad.
So I was about 11 years old, and my dad had been on the road a lot. My mother was having difficulties with her alcoholism and was really becoming more and more unfunctional, really. And my dad recognized there was a void in the parenting department. And he decided that one way we could connect and spend some more time together would be for him to teach me how to A, throw a baseball, B, how to catch a ball, and C, how to hit a ball.
George Carlin not only came home, he came home with a ball, a bat, and a couple of gloves.
And we went down to a park in our neighborhood, and he taught me how to do all those things. And it was great. I mean, it was fun. It's not like I had any real desire to do that kind of stuff, but I got to spend time with my dad.
Did you have the feeling at that point that he really loved baseball? Because he could have taught you fly fishing. He could have taken you to some place where you could toss horseshoes. I mean, anything.
Yeah, well, I think if we had had stickball in my neighborhood growing up, he would have been teaching me stickball because that's what he played on the streets of New York City as a kid.
From stickball, young George Carlin moved on to baseball.
And he was one of those kids who loved the Brooklyn Dodgers, who broke his heart by moving to Los Angeles. And then he later became a Mets fan.
But that's fascinating. The Dodgers moved to L.A., then he moved to L.A., but he didn't remain a Dodgers fan.
Oh, no. I believe once you cross George Carlin, it'll take a long time for forgiveness.
Maybe forgiveness was a problem for the Dodgers, too. Maybe what happened to Carlin during a Dodgers-Mets game he attended in the mid-80s was a result of the team's revenge for his bailing on them when they went west.
Somewhere in the fourth or fifth inning, I think it was, he started having some symptoms, some chest symptoms. And he looked at his manager and he said, I think I'm having a heart attack. And he actually was. And they jumped in the limo, and this limo driver got them from Dodger Stadium, which is downtown, heart of downtown, all the way to my dad's hospital in Santa Monica in under 20 minutes. And thankfully, that hospital happened to be using an experimental anticoagulant that weekend. And they gave him some of that, and it broke up the clot that was damaging his heart. So the Dodgers and the Mets playing gave my dad a heart attack in the 80s.
That's the sort of experience Carlin would feel compelled to turn into a routine. In fact, according to his daughter, he saw possibilities in almost everything that happened to him.
So my dad's creative process was to write everything down. Anything that fascinated him or kind of took his fancy or whatever, he would write it down knowing that there's something in this. So there would be these little strips of paper that he would get that would have, you know, a sentence or two on them. And then he would collect enough of these little scraps of paper into separate little topics like words or kids or death, knowing my dad.
On some of those scraps, there were notes about sports or names of players or characteristics of games that Carlin would one day enjoy comparing.
Football has hitting, clipping, spearing, blocking, piling on, late hitting, unnecessary roughness, and personal fouls. Baseball has the sacrifice.
As it happened, despite sessions of catch with her father, Kelly Carlin didn't become a baseball player. She spent a lot of time on horseback as a youngster, and eventually she discovered the joys of golf, which must have surprised her father.
It is time to reclaim the golf courses from the wealthy and turn them over to the homeless. Golf is an arrogant, elitist game, and it takes up entirely too much room in this country. Too much room.
Ah, well. What child hasn't found it necessary to rebel against a parent at some point? So, Kelly Carlin, golfer. But her father probably forgave her because he had learned many years before his daughter took up the game he called meaningless and mindless how much she appreciated his work, sometimes perhaps despite herself.
I went back to UCLA at age 25. I'd taken 7 years off, decided to go back as a freshman. Because I hadn't been in school for 7 years, they made me take the remedial English class.
Kelly Carlin says she was surrounded by athletes. The young professor's task was to prepare the students and student athletes to write acceptable college essays.
And so he comes into the classroom one morning and he says, all right, so today we're going to learn a little essay type. It's called Compare and Contrast. You'll be asked a lot to use this kind of device in essay writing. And so I'm going to do something a little different here today. I'm going to actually play you a tape of someone who's written the perfect compare and contrast essay. And he pushes the play button And my father's baseball-football routine begins.
Football is played in any kind of weather. Rain, sleet, snow, hail, mud. Can't read the numbers on the field. Can't read the yard markers. Can't read the players' numbers. The struggle will continue. In baseball, if it rains, we don't come out to play.
And I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, great. Here I am at UCLA, forging my own way into the world finally. And my father has followed me. And then I ran home to tell my dad, and he was thrilled. My dad loved that this kid who had dropped out of school in junior high, who had been kicked out of every official institution in his life, was being used as the perfect example of a college essay.
The young professor who liked George Carlin's baseball versus football routine enough to play it in his class had, and has, lots of company. Plenty of listeners who've heard bits of the comedy bit will recall it with a smile. And for Kelly Carlin, who's a writer and host of a radio show, there's more to it than that.
I would say every time I watch baseball or football, my father's routine will jump into my head. It's just there. It's like, ah, there he is. There's Dad making his mark.
Baseball has no time limit. We don't know when it's going to end. We might have extra innings. Football is rigidly timed, and it will end even if we have to go to sudden death.
A new George Carlin career retrospective box set was released this past week. Beginning in August, you'll be able to find the George Carlin archives in the new National Comedy Center in Jamestown, New York. In the summer of 1960, Bill Loiseau's grandfather took him to see a Yankees game.
It was an innocent act of generosity and family fellowship. But unbeknownst to him or me, it started me down that darkening path toward perdition.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, how Dr. Tommy John is trying to make sure more kids don't need the surgery named after his dad. But right now it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The 2018 World Cup is underway and everybody's watching, Charlie, right? Even you?
I did get up on Friday morning early and watch Uruguay and Egypt. See, one of the great things about the World Cup, I don't know much about football, but I'll tell you what, live sports in the morning is over breakfast is a great thing, no matter what you're watching.
And you're going to get a lot of it over the next couple of weeks if you want.
Oh, yeah, because the time differences are ludicrous.
Thursday's opening ceremony got the tournament off to a very fun start. I understand there were birds involved. What was that all about?
Well, one specific bird, Robbie Williams, made the universal gesture of displeasure to a camera during the opening ceremony, and apparently will go down in World Cup history as the worst entertainer ever to appear at a World Cup. I think his hand is now second only to Maradona's in World Cup history. Hey, you got to admit that that's a pretty good reference for somebody who knows nothing.
It's excellent. Excellent. I'm very impressed. The U.S., by the way, is sending more visitors to the current World Cup in Russia than any other country. I hadn't known there were so many fans of Iceland in the U.S.
Well, not only that, Bill, but as you know, relationships between the Russian and American government are at an all-time high, so maybe we're just going over there to see our new friends.
Maybe that's it. Charlie, since we last spoke, another Triple Crown winner has been, well, crowned. Justify won the Belmont Stakes, thereby increasing his value as a dad. His breeding rights have sold for $75 million, so not much chance Justify will race again, I suppose.
I doubt it very seriously. I think we've seen the last of him on the track. It's very strange about Triple Crown winners. They seem to come in bunches. We had Secretariat Affirmed and Seattle Slew, bing, 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 and then didn't have one for years. And then we had American Pharoah not long ago and now Justify. Mm-hmm. If the rule of three prevails, we'll have another one sometime in the next couple of years.
So Justify is the king of horse racing, and for a time, the sport of kings had a queen, too. Is that enough of a hint for you to guess who owns Call to Mind, the horse that paid $560 after winning the Belmont Gold Cup Invitational a week ago?
Well, I suspect it's one of the Queen of England's few non-corgi animals that she owns.
You're right!
Thank you.
And apparently Her Majesty was very pleased, according to a spokesperson.
Well, I hope so. I mean, it's good for the old gal, you know? I mean, I would like to see her some year at Churchill Downs in a big old hat. Of course, she wears big old hats anyway.
Pretty much all the time. This week, a hockey-loving couple married at Disney World's Epcot Center, and they got the surprise of their lives when a tall, statuesque guy named Stanley crashed the party. Who was that?
It was the Stanley Cup, Bill. I didn't know it did weddings.
Bob Myers, the general manager of the Golden State Warriors, announced this week that the team would give Kevin Durant, quote, whatever he wants in contract negotiations. How much do you think he should ask for?
Well, if you're actually doing that, sure, I think he should ask for the Golden Gate Bridge and a few wineries and wine country and, you know, perhaps the deed to the Transamerica Tower.
Former Old Dominion star basketball player and Olympic coach Ann Donovan died on Wednesday. She was only 56. She played before women's college hoops became a much bigger deal, and I think it's fair to say the game owes a lot to her, don't you think?
Oh, there's no question, because not only was she a talented Hall of Fame basketball player, she was an extraordinary coach at every level.
Bartolo Colon recorded strikeout number 2,500 this week, Charlie. At 45 years old, he's tied for 33rd on the all-time list for strikeouts. How many more years do you figure he needs to go before he catches Nolan Ryan at the top of that list with 5,714 strikeouts?
I have no idea how long he's going to pitch, but he can still strike out major league hitters, which probably does prove that hitting a baseball is the hardest thing you can do in sports.
Sometimes you encounter dramatic evidence that you should change jobs. I think it's fair to say that Aaron Laffey, who was a 33-year-old minor league pitcher in the Mets organization, bumped into some of that evidence on Wednesday night. He gave up 14 runs and walked off the mound and said, I quit.
I can see where this guy has just decided to look at baseball and go, yeah, it was fun, but this is going to look bad on my permanent record.
Right. And finally, Charlie, we have another fine candidate for best name temporarily adopted by a minor league baseball team. For 5 games this year, the New York Yankees affiliate on Staten Island will be known as...
The Pizza Rats. And I don't know what that means.
Well, look at the cartoon.
I mean, is that a beloved local street gang from the 1930s or what?
There's nothing like cute rats. You got to recognize that. Cute rats, pizza, viral video.
The only time I've ever been to Staten Island was a result of the fact that I got lost on I-95 and went over the same bridge 4 times. I saw no rats and no pizza.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Can't get enough of Charlie Pierce? Subscribe to Only a Game on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please consider leaving a review of Only a Game. Your comments make me smile, and they also help other listeners to find our show. Nearly a century ago, philosopher Morris R. Cohen suggested that baseball was America's national religion. It was a bold statement, to be sure, and one that has been repeated over the years. But looking back on his own childhood, writer Bill Loiseau wonders if baseball is actually something darker, much darker. Here's Bill.
My father was a Christian Brethren, my mother a Presbyterian, and while I was growing up, I was dimly aware that they'd worked out a deal. On Sunday mornings, my mother, in her pearls, heels, and modestly stylish dresses, would take my 2 younger sisters and me to the Presbyterian church in my hometown of Basking Ridge, New Jersey. Then, collecting my father, we'd all squeeze into our rattly 1959 Ford ranch wagon. A half hour later, At 915 Grant Avenue in Plainfield, my father's aging mother would be waiting for us, tapping her cane in the doorway of the old house where she'd lived for 50 years. Here we entered a different world. Dark, olive-colored drapes, dark rugs, everywhere a faint mothball smell. All was still, all was quiet, except for the slow ticking of the grandfather clock in the hallway, a clock about the size of a coffin. Death was always on my grandmother's mind, as was sin. Sin, she said, is breaking the law of God, especially the Ten Commandments. The stickiest wicket was keeping the Sabbath. In my grandmother's house, the Sabbath was kept holy all day, a day for spiritual rejuvenation. So no Parcheesi or Monopoly, no TV, no radio. As my mother, in an armchair, knitted in a kind of quiet fury, my father, a mild-spoken businessman who honored his mother, would listen and nod while my grandmother read from her small black book of the Gospels. I'm afraid that little of this felt rejuvenating to me, and not only because I lacked interest in the subject matter, but because I'd become very interested in another matter that would complicate the Sabbath. On a sunny Saturday in the previous summer of 1960, my maternal grandfather, a silver-haired Presbyterian in a straw hat, had picked me up and driven me to a Yankees game in the Bronx. It was an innocent act of generosity and family fellowship, but unbeknownst to him or me, it started me down that darkening path toward perdition. The game was glorious. We booed and cheered, my grandfather and I. I was a short, thin, 7-year-old kid with a limp. But from that day until the end of his days, he called me Mantle, the Yankees' incredibly swift, strong home run hitter, the hero of the team. And from then on, I was in love. There is no other word for it, with him and the Yankees. As a Presbyterian, he had no problem with listening to or even attending Sunday afternoon games. "Dear Mantle," his letters always began, "did you hear the game on Sunday?" Well, I'd heard about it. For the rest of that season, except on Sundays, I listened to Yankee games with my ear glued to my parents' big Philco radio in the kitchen. Then, on the following Christmas, my father gave me a white button-down shirt, and my mother gave me an AM transistor radio. I couldn't walk or sit or practically breathe without my fingers around my Lafayette Model FS-91 Mighty 9 transistor. After school, I listened to DJ Jack Carney, and when I was allowed to stay up late on Friday nights, I'd listen to Scott's O'Muni spinning hits like Shop Around, Good Time Baby, and I'm in the Mood for Love, all of which had an obscure and uncomfortable allure. Then in early April, at the beginning of the 1961 baseball season, it came to me like a whisper that was quieter but more powerful than the allure of those top 40 hits. What if I just happened to have my radio in my pocket when we go to grandmother's house? And what if, when we're there, I figure out how to listen to games without anyone knowing? So on a Sunday in mid-April, I slid my radio into the inside pocket of my jacket. Now and then as we traveled to Plainfield, I lightly touched that pocket in the nervous and reassuring way the Catholic girls touch their rosary beads. As my grandmother would have warned, this is how sin works. It worms into your tiniest crevices, grows, overtakes you, then cracks you open. I slumped on the sofa and grimaced as in pain. "What's wrong?" my grandmother asked, frowning and looking up from her little black book. "You aren't going to get sick, are you?" my father said, suddenly energized. "Oh, for heaven's sake," my grandmother said. "He's going to throw up," my sisters cried, bolting up from the sofa. "No, I don't think so," my mother said calmly. She set her knitting aside, came over and put the back of her wrist against my forehead. "I think you're okay, but maybe you should go upstairs and take a rest." This sounded reasonable to everyone. I climbed the stairs to the second floor guest bedroom. It was another dark green room, more the color of pine trees than olives. I slid the Mighty 9 out of my jacket pocket. and suddenly I was feeling sick. What if I get caught? Caught breaking the Sabbath? Then, slowly settling my stomach, there came a soft, smooth, sliding feeling that I couldn't and didn't want to stop. I can do this. I can get away with it. I held the radio in the cup of my hands. With the volume low, I slipped it under the pillow to muffle the sound. And with a keen and guilty pleasure, I closed my eyes. Listening to every word, I drifted away from that room, that house, and my grandmother reading downstairs. I heard the crowd. I smelled the popcorn. The knob turned slowly, and in the shaft of light that came in the room, I saw in silhouette my mother's head with her thin neck and wavy hair. How are things going? Better, I said. She cocked her head as if she'd heard something, but she didn't come in the room. Then she whispered, "Are we winning?" I lifted my head and nodded. "Well, let's keep it that way." The shaft of light narrowed as she closed the door. This breaking the Sabbath continued all through the 1961 season, when Yankees pitcher Whitey Ford won 25 games and didn't lose one on a Sunday. Most memorably, it was the season when Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris chased Babe Ruth's record of 60 home runs. As it happened, Mantle hit a home run on the Yankees' first Sunday game of that year. On the last, October 1st, Maris hit his record-breaking 61st, and I heard it. Phil Rizzuto making the call.
Here's the windup. Fastball hits deep to right. It could be it. Way back there. Holy cow!
Never has the Sabbath been so deliciously violated, so gloriously unholy, so unkept. My grandmother was right. Given a toehold, sin engulfed me. It cleaved me. And cloven, I became what I've been ever since. That kid who went to church on Sunday mornings, and the kid who listened to his Lafayette Mighty Nine in that guest room on those Sunday afternoons, when I sinned with all my heart and soul.
Bill Loiseau is an award-winning writer of books and short stories. He's also the writer-in-residence at Boston University. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word this week comes from the late George Carlin, who really, really loved the game of golf.
And a mindless game, mindless. Think of the intellect it must take to draw pleasure from this activity. Hitting a ball with a crooked stick, and then walking after it.
Yeah, or riding after it in a little cart. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.